Welcome back, loyal listeners, to another episode of Lifetime Cinema Club, the little podcast undergoing a big project, and that is to count down the top 10 films from each year of my life, from 1980 until present day. And as always, I'm your host, Ryan, and I'm joined by the guy who actually does all of the research. Well, I'm just here for the vibes. It's my buddy, Holsh. How you doing, mate?
Really good, mate. Really good. Ready to go. Raring to go, actually. This is something I've never sort of seen this style before, so really excited.
Definitely an epic, that's for sure, and one that is just a beautiful film to take in. Now, if you joined us last episode, you would have heard us discuss an underrated gem, which came in at number 5 for the year 1980, and that is William Peter Blatty's The Ninth Configuration. And it's a film that attempts to answer life's biggest question, is there a God? And also acts as the connective tissue between the OG Exorcist from 73 and Blatty's directorial follow-up, 1990's The Exorcist 3. So that was number 5, and this week that means we're up to number 4, the film that lands in the 4th position for my 1980 rankings. Now, if you have been joining us so far on this journey, you would have known that I've been naming and collecting goats along the way, the greatest of all time performers and directors. Who have I added so far, Holsh? I know there's been Teresa Russell and Harvey Keitel both got goated.
De Niro. And
De Niro.
Scorsese.
Scorsese. There's Joe Spinell as the cameo goat.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there was more. I'm sure.
Oh, Al Pacino in Cruising.
Ah, yes. Yep.
Al Pacino's dancing, more like it, in Cruising, is definitely goated.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I love how passive-aggressive you were with that response.
I think you're going to have to build a few more pens on this farm because they're running out of grass to eat.
Oh, it's going to be, yeah, this goat farm's getting fucking huge. But guess what? For this episode, we're adding another goat to this farm, and this guy might just be the king goat. This guy might be the goat that rules all goats. A director who has influenced everyone, and saying that is no exaggeration. I speak, of course, of Akira Kurosawa, and coming in at 4 is his historical epic, Kagemusha.
The Lifetime Cinema Club.
Now, before our thoughts on the film, and before we discuss how we feel about the film, before we butcher all of these Japanese names, apologies in advance, I'll quickly use the letterboxed plot summary, as I always do, to quickly describe the film. And it is as follows. Akira Kurosawa's lauded feudal epic presents the tale of a petty thief who is recruited to impersonate Shingen, an aging warlord, in order to avoid attacks from competing clans. When Shingen dies, his generals reluctantly agree to have the imposter take over as the powerful ruler. He soon begins to appreciate life as Shingen, but his commitment to the role is tested when he must lead his troops into battle against the forces of a rival warlord. That basically sums it all up pretty nicely. It is a quite involved and complicated film at times, and as we said before, it is an epic. This is a 3-plus-hour film, which might scare some people off. How did you find it, Holsh? Was this your first Kurosawa film?
This is my first Kurosawa film, and also from your 10 so far, this is the first one that is in a foreign language, unless you count Inferno, but Inferno had the dubbed English over the top. So it's introduced me to a few different aspects to theatre out there. And look, I thought the 3 hours I actually broke up into two, I won't lie. I watched an hour and a half and then another hour and a half later on. But the US, when they released it in the US, it was actually 20 minutes shorter. I watched the commentary yesterday, and a couple of the scenes that they missed out seemed really crucial to it. But in all honesty, mate, just blown away by the visuals, and the 180 minutes flew by.
it is a pretty brisk 3 hours. I've got to admit, I broke it up over two viewings as well this time around, but this is more lifestyle related, having two young children that are constantly in need of looking after. I had to break this up over 2 days, unfortunately, but it is a, I find it at least, an easy 3 hour watch. There are critics out there that say that this is basically a slower paced trial run for the film Ran, which comes out 5 years after this from Kurosawa. But this film, one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen in my life. The lead role of the warlord Shingen and his Kagemusha, or Shadow Warrior is the translation for Kagemusha, is played by Japanese samurai film legend Tatsuya Nakadai, who famously starred in possibly what many would call, and I would be close to agreeing with, the greatest samurai film of all time, Harakiri, along with other classics like The Sword of Doom, Samurai Rebellion, and Goryeoken. He was also the lead in influential psychological thriller The Face of Another, which came out in the late 60s, and also had large or leading roles in other Kurosawa films such as High and Low. High and Low is probably close to being my personal favorite Kurosawa film. He also starred in Ran, Yojimbo, and Sanjuro.
Can I ask a question there, Chip?
Certainly.
So as I said earlier, this is my first ever Kurosawa film. And yeah, as you said, this particular movie is probably based more around a historical focused epic rather than an action samurai piece. Now, having not seen Kurosawa's earlier works like Seven Samurai and the like, are they more action packed, or, you know, more action scenes and more of sort of visual violence? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, a lot of the early samurai films are a little bit faster in pace, do feature a little bit more action. This, I mean, Seven Samurai does have its moments of contemplation and has its more drawn out static shots and long shots, which feature heavily in Kagemusha. But yeah, I would say this is more of a contemplative work for him, a slower pace, less focus on the battles. Like, there is an incredible battle scene, which we'll get to later when we talk about this film, but it is grand in scope and in epic in scale, but it doesn't go for very long. So no, you can expect a lot more action. And he didn't just dive into samurai films as well. There's some really great crime films that Kurosawa did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Well worth checking out. Like I said before, High and Low is probably one of my favorite Kurosawa films, and it's a crime film. It's brilliant, and it basically inspired so many films after that too, up until current day. So, yeah, this would be one of the, I guess, less action-packed films in his portfolio.
Yeah, okay.
But I think it's probably my personal favorite shot film of his. The combination of color and the different compositions he uses with his shot making in this film are just sensational.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting you explain that. So, yeah, that gives me a bit more of a insight into his other films, because, yeah, that was one of the first things I noticed with this film, was when the battles came in, there wasn't so much focus on the battle itself, but more so the, you know, the destruction, the bloodshed, the tragedy of the aftermath of war. So I just wanted to see if that was something that was common with Kurosawa.
I mean, he touches on those, the fallout of war and the fallout of violence in other films as well, but this is the one that he really, really focuses on. And I don't want to give away an observation that I had too early, but this is a film that marked a bit of a comeback for him through a very lean, productivity-wise, 1970s decade for him, where he struggled to get funding and struggled to get anybody to support him. So I think there's a little bit of hangover from that in this film, and I'll mention that again a bit later.
Okay.
The film itself centers around the Civil War in 1572, which is also a period known as the Sengoku period, and the battles between multiple factions over the conquest of Kyoto. The main clans contesting this battle are the Takeda clan, the Oda clan, and the Tokugawa clan. We follow the story of Shingen Takeda, the lord of the Takeda clan, and the discovery of his identical lookalike by his brother. Now, the lookalike was sentenced to crucifixion because of what he claims was a petty theft. But he was also suspected in a murder as well, as they mentioned in this opening scene of the film. He is granted a second chance, however, as long as he goes along as the secretive body double for Shingen. Visually, this film, as we've already said numerous times in the first 5 or 10 minutes, visually this film is just exquisite. So Kurosawa's eye was already legendary by this point. Kagemusha proves that he still has the juice after a difficult stretch in the 70s, like we said. He just lost favor with the studios. He couldn't get financial backers. He couldn't get anyone to fund his work or believe in his work. He actually ended up getting some Soviet Union-backed funds and money to produce and direct a film in the 70s as well. This struggle through that entire decade led him to become deeply depressed and borderline suicidal. There's even reports that he may have attempted suicide at one time. And watching this film, I struggle to accept that an artist like him, right, who has – he's influenced everyone and every style of filmmaking, and you can say that about action films, thrillers, crime films, even to modern-day slow cinema. And everyone has been influenced by him. And for him to be essentially shunned for almost a decade is just – mind-blowing. So his eye for detail, the framing of his characters, his ability to film static shots, still long takes, along with flowing action scenes, is second to none. And probably only John Ford, I would say, compares to him or is on his level. And to get this film made, it took basically the insistence or the help from George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola, two directors who owe so much of their own success to Kurosawa, especially Lucas, it must be said. We all know that story, or we all know that Star Wars is deeply influenced by a few of the early Kurosawa works, particularly The Hidden Fortress, and also there's elements of Seven Samurai and other pieces of Kurosawa's work that are littered through Lucas's original Star Wars trilogy. But it took those guys to basically largely fund this project. And it was after discussions with Kurosawa about getting him back working, he mentioned to Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola that he always wanted to make this historic epic. And he had already storyboarded everything, and he'd already like painted all these incredible scenes out and had this visual storyboard just ready to go. And I guess once they saw that, they were quite happy to front up the money. Do you have anything more to add to that, Holst? I know you've watched the special features on the Blu-ray.
Not really. I mean, yeah, I think it's really cool that, you know, Lucas and Coppola, this guy was their hero, their mentor, and for them to come in and help this guy at his lowest point, where Toho Studios, who he'd worked with for quite a while, I think he had a couple of flops as far as commercial releases, and then Toho Studios. I think Kurosawa was known for going over budget, taking longer than he needed and so forth when he had these given budgets. And Toho Studios came to a point where they said, no, we can't continue to do this in case, you know, it's another flop. And yes, Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola came to the party, and they also introduced, I think through one of the other studios, to ensure it also got a US release, which was unusual at the time. So it not only became a hit, and it was a huge hit in Japan, and it was also quite successful in the US, and that obviously set the scene and established a base for him to go on 5 years later for Ran. But yeah, 5,000 extras, which was at the time the largest, probably still is close to the largest cast, I guess, that any film's ever had. I forget how much it cost them to make it at the time. I think it was $7 million or something along those lines, which also was the highest budget ever in Japanese cinema up until that date. But yeah, incredible story with Lucas and Coppola.
I guess the carrot of having it released into cinemas into the US is quite the quite the thing to aspire to for any type of foreign filmmaker. I guess I use foreign as basically non-Hollywood. The fact that this was a success, considering the length, and if you don't have an understanding of Japanese culture or history, It can be a little bit confusing at times, this film. You don't need to be an expert on it, but a little bit of context would open things up. It's encouraging to know that this was a success. And like you said, too, with the amount of extras used in this thing, we are before the days of green screen CGI. All the people on horseback are actually people on horseback. It is an incredible sight to see some of these battle scenes. And look, the visuals of note in this film, there are many, with the battle scenes, like we said, being just spectacular in scope. And obviously the famous dream sequence scene, which we'll get to later, that's the one real notable scene that people always seem to talk about, or when I'm deep in a Twitter, film Twitter kind of doom scroll, whenever I see someone bring up Kagamusha, it's always the dream sequence stills. I've always just taken photos of the dream sequence, which is understandable because it's absolutely fucking gorgeous. Some of the most beautiful colors and just an incredible scene. They're always the popular talking points. But what I find most fascinating about this film for me is the filming of interiors and of intimate conversations. Those really stand out. There's also, you know, landscape shots of snow-capped mountains and these royal castles or temples and the small villages. They're also lovingly captured. And that's the thing I love about Kurosawa, the way he shoots, is that he adores everything he shoots. That sounds really corny and wanky, but I feel like everything you're looking at, there's just a real attention and care to what he is filming.
I found the fashion through the whole thing is just mind-blowing. Not just the generals, but the fact that every single army extra has these phenomenal, you know, samurai outfits. I could not get over it. Then the colors as well of these costumes, especially in the internal shots where the room and the setting itself is very natural, but then the colors are almost like hyper real in really like pronounced. But like you said, it's just that attention to detail and amazing. You're spot on with the landscapes, and also the color blue through the whole film is just, it takes me back to Inferno a little bit, but it's really pronounced as well. And the more that you watch through the film, the more you sort of notice that it symbolizes death through it, with a certain jar that comes into play later in the scene. And after a certain point in time, things start turning blue. That sort of points to the Tagata clan.
Yep.
So yeah, look, visually, this movie, I rank all my movies with certain categories, and for visuals, I just cinematography 10 out of 10. This is the absolute pinnacle.
One of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. I'm glad you brought up the costumes, actually, because one little tidbit of information that came across my desk here at Lifetime Cinema Club Studio was that the costumes used here were mostly recreations and props. However, if you're like me and you've seen way too much Antiques Roadshows, if you've seen too many of those episodes and thought, fuck, that armor looks very realistic, then you are correct, because some of the armor in this used was actually loaned to Kurosawa from various museums and historical foundations to ensure its authenticity. So there are pieces, I'm not entirely sure which pieces were actual relics from 500 years ago, but there are quite a few pieces of costume in this that are traditional and absolute antiques from that time. That's just the Kurosawa way, man, just making everything pop. Look, an example of a scene, like I just said before, of interiors and of intimate conversations that at first seems low-key or, dare I say, kind of bland, upon further watching just opens up, is the very, very first scene, the opening scene to the film, which is about 6 minutes in length. And it's just Shingen and Shingen's brother, Nobukado, introducing the lookalike and describing how he found him and talking about his history. It's a static long shot. There's no movement, but it's a scene in which I will always rewatch. There's thankfully YouTube have like all these scene breakdowns of this film, and if you just want to watch this opening 6 minutes, you can. And I've rewatched this quite a few times over the years. It's so simple, and yet it's so powerful, and it progresses the narrative so easily and effortlessly. You had a cool discovery that my dumbass never noticed about this opening scene, Holsh. I've seen this film. This is probably my fourth time I've seen it, and I've watched that scene dozens of times, but I never really thought of this. What did you find about this scene?
There's so many incredible scenes in this film, and this one still is the one that sticks in my mind the most. And as you said, it sets up the entire film. And the movie revolves prominently around, you know, this one man's identity being the daimyo or Shingen, the leader, imprinting himself over the lives of others. And what's really present right through the entire film is how Kurosawa employs shadows and give it really good meaning behind it all. And obviously that ties in with the name Kagemusha, the shadow warrior. And in this film, you've got Shingen in the middle, and then you've got his brother, who is his current shadow or double when in times where he can't expose himself. And then on the right-hand side, we have the thief who ends up becoming the Kagemusha. You'll notice that both the brother and the thief do not have a shadow in this particular scene, but Shingen in the middle has this really really prominent shadow on the wall.
It's a huge shadow, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really overarching the whole scene to a degree once you notice it, and it's positioned between him and his brother, because his brother at this point in time is his double, so the shadow is sort of representing that. Now, another thing that's only noticed on the second watch is if you watch every movement that Shingen undertakes in this first scene, his brother will mimic it. It's often slightly delayed, but if he strokes his mustache, his brother a second later will stroke his mustache. If he tosses his gown sort of with his arm to the side, way out the sides, then his brother will do it, because this is another symbol that his brother is essentially this guy's shadow. And it's really, really clever how Kurosawa establishes this, you know, immediately. Wow. And I just think, you know, right through the film as we go through, there's a couple other little instances, but there's so much thought into every single shot that this bloke does. It blows me away.
I never noticed the non-shadow on the Kagemusha. I noticed the mimicking of mannerisms with his brother, but I just, for whatever reason, never noticed the non-shadow, which is, you know, it's, again, Kurosawa says so much about this film and about the theme going forward in the first 6 minutes in a shot that doesn't have any movement in it whatsoever. The characters move slightly. There is no camera movement. It's a 6 minute static long shot, and it just describes everything so well. And that's a great example of the simplicity, but also the deep nuance that he has when it comes to filmmaking. The other scenes that we love that are just so visually pleasing are the scenes of the skies. The skies in this film are incredible. So there's just pure Kino, just fucking magical to look at. There's golden sunsets interrupted by marching troops over a ridge. There's blood red and deep purple strobing lights atop a battlefield. And then there's those beautiful blues, like you mentioned before, Holsh, just across fields. Mm. It's just pure artistry on display. I was watching this on an old DVD rip that I downloaded and fucking torrented about 10 years ago, and it still slaps so hard. I can only imagine what the Blu-ray experience is like on this. And even the YouTube clips that I was watching on it this afternoon, where people are doing a few little video essay breakdowns, the picture quality was so much better than the copy I've got. So my next purchase is going to have to be the Criterion Blu-ray on this.
Yeah. No, it's really, it's such a beautiful watch. On the OLED here, I was like in heaven. So,
I bet. Oh, man, I'm so jealous. Fuck.
And before we move on, just one last thing with that opening scene.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, I had no fucking idea that that was the same actor as in Shingen and the thief. I was like, this is 1980, and they have somehow split the film, however they've done the edit, to have both And, you know, these days, obviously, this is second nature. But in 1980, to have the same actor in that opening shot for 6 minutes without a cut, I thought was just mind-blowing. I was like halfway through the movie, I'm like, are they the same actor?
Yeah.
I thought that was so cleverly done. Oh, and his acting is so contrasting that I was just like, no, that's a different bloke. It's a different bloke. Anyway, that opening scene, we've got to move on from it, but far out. It's insane.
Yeah, there's more famous scenes in this film, but to say the opening is my favourite is an understatement. That is just one of my favourite cold opens to any movie. It really is. While we're here talking about the visual aesthetic, I guess we should probably talk about the other parts of the film as well, mostly the sound. For me, I just want to make note of the sound design and the score. We've spoken about the costume design and the use of actual real antiques, but the score was composed by Shinichiro Akibe, and he crafts a real majestic and sweeping sound to the film, which never really threatens to overtake the scenes. It just complements everything so well. The sound design was courtesy of Fumio Yamaguchi, who collaborated frequently with Kurosawa, and he was responsible for sound design on a lot of Kurosawa's films, but also a lot of the numerous Godzilla sequels. The sound touches here are so well introduced and weaved through, with natural elements everywhere as well, like sounds like the horses, armies marching, wind, all the elements. It just works perfectly. The thing that I noticed most on my last rewatch, though, is the intensity of the gunshots. It's not quite to the level of the absolute GOAT film of all time, Heat, from 1995. But for a film that is using primitive guns and weapons as of, you know, the historical accuracy, the sound of the gunshots is each time, they're just like gut punches every time I hear one.
Spot on. I think you covered everything there, mate. The wind that he uses throughout this film was something that really stood out to me. And it appears like they seem to bring it in whenever it's like a real high drama part of the film. And, you know, even different moments like in the dream sequence where he's putting his feet through the water and they use the sound of the ocean sort of comes and sweeps over the top. I just think incredible, and the way that it gives you this otherworldly feel to it. So
yeah,
incredible, mate.
There's that's a bit of a Kurosawa calling card too, is elemental sound design. A lot of those early films, those samurai films, really have incredible wind, rain effects and sound design to them. He and his crew just mastered that from the get-go. And they give so much of the atmosphere to the films. It's incredible. The film, as we've touched on, obviously revolves around the Kagemusha, the shadow warrior or lookalike for Lord Shingen. Basically, he has been put into place to be the double, and as it turns out, eventually succeed as the Lord after Shingen is mortally wounded by a sniper. Before his death, Shingen wishes for the Kagemusha to stay in place or to keep up the facade for, is it 3 years, I believe, Holsh?
Yeah, 3 years is the attempt.
And that's what he attempts to do. And it's all about ensuring the strength and integrity of the clan. He doesn't want the clan to come across as being weakened by any stretch, because there are all these other factions out there that want to take control and want to basically conquer Kyoto as well. Now, rumors swirl around of Shingen's demise between the other warring factions. And in some of my favorite scenes, we see the opposing warlords lament the apparent pending death of Shingen. I really like those scenes. I was like, despite just battling against him and trying to basically off each other for power, there's just still this really deep respect shown to Shingen from the other leaders as a leader. It leads them to be quite saddened in a way.
Yeah, it's such a Japanese thing. Everything with the Japanese culture is just built around respect, and I thought it was really cool how they showed these clan leaders and how, you know, they weren't overjoyed at the thought of the loss of this, you know, this great warrior and a clan that obviously was feared and they knew was a genuine threat to take over Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. That depiction of sadness and they were like pre-mourning the fact that, well, we hear that Shingen's mortally wounded, he's not long for the earth. A few of their, I guess, underlings were like, this is great news, isn't it? And they'd be like, well, no, this is a fearless warlord. This is a very strong and brave man. We should respect his passing. That sadness, though, doesn't last long because despite the assurance of various spies that Shingen is near death, he magically reappears stronger and in good health, leading them to suspect that a double is being used, but never being able to completely prove it, at least initially. What I've always felt that Kurosawa was commenting on or saying with this film is something very personal for him. This is just my theory and thought on this. I think that he noticed or knew of this story because it's a historical story from feudal era Japan. And I think he realized how much it related to him and his current state in the 70s. And I think why he was drawn to make this film is because he was probably feeling imposter syndrome, which I know that two guys who were talking on this podcast have spoken to each other about feeling this way as well. I feel like this is imposter syndrome, the film. I've got a feeling that the depression and the feelings of inadequacy that Kurosawa felt through the end of the 70s, you know, after all the success and all the accolades he had in that multiple decades prior, left him to consider that he was actually a phony and if he was himself a shadow of his former self. Yeah. And I think this film is probably the most personal film that Kurosawa ever made. And he made a lot of films, especially a few of his late career ones into the early 90s were very personal films. But I think this is the most personal, most important film to him. But he even played that down in public, which people who suffer from depression and imposter syndrome are likely to do about something that's very personal to them. I know that myself, I suffer, and I know we've spoken about this too, mate, where we go through depressive episodes. You kind of play it down to people to give off an air of somewhat you've got stuff in control. He even said multiple times to the media that he saw this film as, or Kurosawa's own words, was almost, he kind of dismissed Kagemusha a little bit and said it was a trial run for Ran, which was made a few years after that. But my personal belief is that this is a film that he needed to make and its themes meant so much to him and it was a true passion project. And it's basically a story about imposter syndrome.
Wow. Yeah, that makes complete sense now that you've explained it. Gee, it makes me feel a bit like the ninth configuration last week to William Peter Blatty. It's two very personal films to the director in a row.
Yeah. So. It just kind of dawned on me more so in this last watch is that, you know, the circumstances around how the film was made, his personal circumstances, mm-hmm. his mindset leading up to this. I just think too many things kind of connect there for me. And, yeah, like I said, even though he kind of played the significance of this film down a little bit to certain people, to the media, to other people in the industry, I just think that he himself was feeling like an imposter and he's made a film that just mimicked his feelings but just based it on a historical fact or a historical story from his homeland. Now, we get on to a few important scenes that we really enjoyed, and I know that you wanted to discuss the sniper scene, Hulsh.
Yeah, so this one's probably not all that exciting as such, but I think it's an important one in the scheme of this film. Now, Kurosawa was procedural in a lot of ways in that he wanted to ensure the viewer knew exactly why things happened. In some areas, he wanted to be vague, but in other areas, he felt that it needed to have some clarity so people could understand the latter parts of the film. And one big difference that I've read, because I have, like I said, I've only seen this Kurosawa film, but in his previous films that involve samurais, it was mainly one-on-one combat with swords being the choice weapon. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yep, correct.
Yep. So this film has a lot more emphasis on the guns being used. And these particular guns were called Tanegashima. They were basically one shot at a time. And this film that they've brought in to explain how the sniper hit Shingen, because Shingen came up, the reason he got shot was he wanted to listen to this flute player, and he wanted to get up quite close so that, you know, he could hear how wonderful this flute player was from this particular castle that they were invading at the time and succeeding at this point in time. He uses this plumb bob, and it's pretty good. Pretty amazing if it really works. But he's using this plumb bob, and then it shows him loading up a single bullet into this Tanegashima gun, and it really shows that it takes a good minute to get one shot ready. And later in the film, it's really important to know that this particular clan that was using these guns had really advanced strategies to them so that they could offload rounds of guns a lot more quickly than what ended up being the Takeda clan. To a lot of people that watched it, and the first time I watched it, there really wasn't much, like, I was like, do we even need this scene? But
yep.
But what Kurosawa is doing is saying, you know what, this is very different from other movies, and you need to understand that this is warfare now. So much so that swords aren't even in this film. The infantry use lances in this film rather than swords. But that was all I wanted to point out on that particular scene.
What I love about this scene is that point of view shot, or that view through that triangle window out onto the courtyard where Shingen gets hit. You don't see that happen from that point of view, but you see where he's been shot from. And that view through that triangle gap or window, it's not really a window, but that triangle is just, I love that shot. And when he's demonstrating and he hits that tree with the shot, and it just freaks out all the other people that are sitting around there at that time. I love that scene. There's little elements of tiny little subtle elements of comedy in a few of these scenes as well.
Definitely.
And that's one of them. There's a little bit of humor in that, a little bit of dry humor. Another scene that I really want to talk about too is the grandson scene when Keigo Musha is in full effect as Shingen, and only the real close insiders know about it. And he is home to see his family, and his grandson is sitting in front of him. And the first thing his grandson says is, "He is not my grandfather." And then everyone's like, "Oh, no, he's just been at war for so long, and war changes a man, and he's just sitting a little bit differently," because there's little things that are giveaways. So, like, there's posture and mannerisms and things that people close to him would probably pick up on.
Mm.
But then the kid says, "No, it's not that. He's just not scary anymore," which is the major thing that comes out. And then everyone just laughs and they go on. And, look, that's a tipping point right there, because as we'll find out later on in the film, that Kagemusha is becoming more and more comfortable with his role as Shingen. And I think it's a sense of duty, but also a sense of belonging. We don't really know too much about his background besides the fact that he was a petty criminal. But I think signs of affection from Shingen's grandson helps him accept the fact that he's become this person now, that he's kind of submitted his old identity into this new identity. And I guess there's also the power at play towards the end too, where he feels like this power to command all these people to do what he says is at play as well. But I also think there's a somewhat of a bit of love involved in his transformation.
Yeah, for sure. That's his greatest connection. This is where I want to be in life now because of this child, almost.
Yep, that's right. I really like that scene, that initial grandson scene. And all these scenes going forward with those two together are some of my favourites. Now, you've mentioned here, Hulsh, too, about the arrangement of the armies. What did you notice there?
Yeah, well, this is another real big visual tool that he uses. The armies, something that stuck out to me, and obviously, like, I've seen a lot of war movies, but not Japanese war movies, and to see different military units that have their own color. So, yep. You know, one's green, one's blue, I think, and one's red. And anyway, there's a wonderful scene right at the beginning of the film. I think it's like almost straight after that internal scene we spoke before, where it's got this messenger, and he looks like he's covered in mud, or he's brown, and he's sprinting through all these staircases. And
oh, that's such a well shot scene.
Oh, it just straight away it had me like I just sitting up going, this is really eye catching. And so he's running through the green. So there's the wind, the forest, the fire, and the mountain, and it's all part of that Sun Tzu's The Art of War. So one of the military units is the wind, then the forest, and then the elite samurai are the fire. I think they're known as the Red Brigade in reality. And then the mountain is Shingen. So Shingen's the guy that is unmovable. He's the pillar, the rock for this clan. And it's interesting when you see, like you said, like when you see them sort of moving through the countryside, etc. Like there's some on horseback, there's some walking. Apparently, as far as culture at that time, the most elite samurai were allowed to ride on the horseback. The infantry just on foot, they essentially might have zero training. They could just be like a farm boy that's been dragged in to be part.
Well, I think that's how feudal Japan worked, right? So you were given parcels of land as long as you then committed to being part of an armed force or being part of the clan when it came to warfare. You get this parcel of property, but how you're taxed on that or the rates that you pay is that you have to go to war when war is called.
It's also interesting, all of them carry a flag. So each individual has a flag as well that's either attached to the horse or they're carrying in their hand. And in that first scene that I mentioned where the messengers sprinting through and, you know, they're sort of waking up, well, not waking up, but they're jumping up startled from their rest because he's obviously got something really important to deliver to the generals. And he also carries a flag the whole way as well that's got a centipede on it, which is the many-footed creature, which represented messengers back in the time. Once again, the use of color and the armies, I just thought was, it just meant like even these areas where they're just walking through fields were so vibrant because of how he used them.
And the historical accuracy on this is incredible too. Kurosawa just did so much research on this, and he's a massive history buff, as is well documented. But apparently there are a few, and again, not being Japanese, there are some cultural things in this that have mainly probably slipped by both of us. But as far as we can tell and as far as I've read, this is such a close to historically accurate war epic as you will get. So all of those flags and all of those clan insignias, would you call them? I don't want to say logo. That's a modern term, but yeah, would be so accurate to what it was. Mm. And you said there was another shadow scene that you wanted to mention when the army retreats when Shingen is injured. I didn't notice this. Can you fill me in on that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite visuals in the whole film. So, and it's also a key aspect to the story of the film. So they're invading this castle. It's basically a matter of time when they're going to take over this castle. And that's when Shingen is shot because he's during the night he's gone up to listen to the flute man.
They love the flute man. The flute man was just, he was doing banger after banger on that flute.
So, you know, he's now in critical shape. So he's been put in one of those palanquins and they're carrying him along. And it gets to a point where they're like, oh, we better check on this guy.
And this bit's incredible with the snow-capped mountains in the background. That is just pure Kino.
It is. It's stunning. And, you know, he gets out and he thinks he can see Kyoto, even though, because that's where, you know, he dreams of taking over it in the future. And he sort of has this one last epiphany and then he carks it. There's only three people there at the time, one of the generals and a doctor and an assistant. And at this time, this general, who's probably one of the higher ranking generals in the group, the elder gentleman, they ended up retreating because of Shingen's state. This is one of the big clues that leads the other clans to go, what the fuck's going on here? Because they were going to win this war, this mini war. Yeah. And anyway, then when it shows them trekking back to their homeland or their area, it becomes this dawn, so big red sky behind and the silhouettes of them walking along the hill and down around the hill back home. And this visual of them all basically shadows of themselves shows this is the beginning of the end for this clan, because when they were attacking and everything, it was basically in daylight and they're on top of everything, and then all of a sudden, okay, no, we're going to retreat. This is what sparked up all the other clans to go, okay, I think we've got these guys. If you watch it again, you'll know the scene I'm talking about. It's got the horizon, the top of the hill, and they're all marching from right to left. And then
it's a beautiful scene.
Yeah. So it's just another area that he's used shadows to show that, you know, Shingen, as he is hurt and he is the one that overarches this whole clan, you know, it's sort of like the shadows dawning as it is with the clan itself.
Incredibly shot piece, and shadow is such a formidable element to this film. It's used in so many different ways as well, and mostly in a formidable way. It's basically the slight touch of death is right on your shoulder, which is what your shadow is in this film. The scene, and we spoke of it earlier quickly, the scene that is most often referenced and most often used as the best scene of this film is the dream scene. The use of color in this is incredible, and sound is just incredible. It goes for about, I would say, it's about 4 or 5 minutes, and it is just so beautiful to watch. I could have watched 55 minutes of this fucking scene. It is incredible. I always took it as both a anxious dream, a worried soul, a worried person dreaming about being inadequate and living up to Shingen and trying to almost live up to this unattainable person or mythic type of person. I also saw it as an afterlife premonition as well, like he's being stalked by Shingen. And as we would find out later in the film, it is somewhat of a premonition. What were your thoughts on this scene, Holst, being the first time you saw it?
The first time I watched it, I just let it soak in. I was like, this is just something that I need to switch off and not sort of care about what it means too much. And I just thought it was mesmerizing from
the start. That's the best way to watch this film first up. Yeah. And even, you know, sometimes you can get too bogged down in details. I know I do sometimes. And I've changed my mindset of watching films over the years to just let things wash over me a little bit, just enjoy the visual aspects of things. And this is a perfect film to do that.
Yeah.
This is perfect background film too. If you just want to have some beautiful visuals on a big TV with it, just play it on mute. Yep. If you've got other things to do, this is just an incredible background film to have as well.
Actually, one question with that dream scene. Now, I haven't seen Kurosawa's Dreams movie, which came out about 10 or 15 years later. On the commentary, the gentleman that's the expert, he believes that this dream scene is better than any of the dream scenes in that particular film. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
I would agree, because I'm more partial to like a haunting kind of dream sequence, which this is. Dreams is a really, really cool, nice, visually spectacular film. I think it was 1990. It might have been one of the last films that Kurosawa made, actually. And when I said before about Kagemusha being what I believe deep down would be his most personal film, the other one I was thinking of would be Dreams. I've only seen Dreams once, but I would probably agree with what that gentleman said on the special features. I would probably agree that this dream sequence trumps anything that's in the actual film called Dreams. It's just spectacular. And like I said, whenever I'm doom scrolling through Twitter and this film gets brought up, it's always stills of this particular scene. It gets a little bit frustrating at times because I'm like, guys, there was another fucking 2 hours and 55 minutes worth of incredible vision that you could pluck from this entire movie. If you just go through and just do a screen capture every fucking 20 seconds, you'll get something spectacular. But I guess it speaks to how beautiful this scene is and how striking it is that it's just spoken of so highly to this day.
In my second viewing of it, I thought to myself, look, I'm going to sit back, be my autistic self and try and work out what it means. And I think you were right before where, you know, the anxiety of trying to live up to Shingen, it's a funny dream in that it starts with Shingen appearing and basically stomping after him, and he's shitting himself. He's like, fuck, keep away from me. I know I'm not the man you are. He's just trying to keep clear of him. But the second that Shingen turns around and walks away, he's like, fuck, I need you. I need you. I love where I am right now. So don't go. So it's sort of like this really clever can't win situation, because
it's a real push and pull, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because he's scared of failing Shingen, but at the same time, he's like, but I don't want to go back to the thief because I'm happy with where I am now. So it's like, don't want him chasing me, but I don't want him to leave. So it's this, you know, it's a bit of a paradox for him. And
he's faced with death either way. So he was basically going to be executed, a really slow type of execution too, before being found. Or you can go charging headlong into these fucking bloody battles and get killed as well. Mm. It's the honor in it, I think, that he becomes obsessed with. He's never been thought of that way before or seen that way before with that honor, and the love that he gets with, obviously, with the grandson and all of that rolled into this, is it's basically he is now willing to lay down his true identity and fully absorb what it is to become Shingen. And it's what he finally understands as being, this is the role I have to play, and he starts to enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure.
So the film essentially is, again, another one of these films, and we've touched on a fair few of these movies so far about identity. You know, there's elements of it in Cruising. Definitely there's elements of it in The Ninth Configuration, and Bad Timing as well. Yeah. Identity is such a major... what it is to be, who are you? What is it meant to be an individual? How do you shun what it is that makes you an individual, and how can you become someone or something else is the real key part of this film. You also mentioned, Holst, about the horse scene. What were you going to mention there?
Yeah, look, just a minor mention on that one. So earlier in the movie, he actually is introduced to Shingen's mistresses or his lovers. Once again, you can't get people much closer to him than those that he sleeps with. And his brother basically says, oh, look, he needs to rest at the moment. So, you know, no sex and all the rest of it. And the girl's like, no, this is not you. And he's like, he basically confesses. He's just like, yep, that's it. It's too hard. I'm not the real Shingen, all the rest of it. And anyway, that feels like the TP, the turning point for him, because they just start laughing. The brother starts laughing with it after he was, you know, had his ass cheeks puckering up, thinking this is it, he's screwing everything up. And all these mistresses are like, just like, oh, you're so funny.
You're crazy.
Yeah. And he gives him the wink across the floor. And the reason I think that is the big TP is because his shadow, he finally, for the first time in the film, he has a shadow of his own.
And it's quite it's huge behind him as well.
Yeah, he gets up and starts moving, and it basically encroaches right across the ceiling.
Yeah, it takes up the whole room almost.
Yeah, and it's more and more has gone on where, say, the grandson now believes it's him, the mistresses now believe it's him, everyone close to him believes it's him.
So it's adding to the mystique. So the shadow is growing.
That's right. But the one fucking creature that will never mistake him is his horse. And his particular horse is sort of shown a few times earlier in the film as being like hell to try and ride. Like no one can ride it but Shingen. And this bloke trying to impress his grandson in this particular, he falls off it earlier and right at the beginning of trying to be Shingen, but no one sees it. And then, yeah, he's trying to show his grandson that he can ride it, falls off. I think one of the mistresses actually checks and notices that he doesn't have a scar where he was shot by this sniper. And that's what exposes everything to the clan and basically makes him an outlier again.
That early scene where he falls off the horse is another one of those real subtle comedy beats that I love, where he's going on the front line of his troops and he's like, yeah, yeah, and the horse just fucking bolts and he has this massive stack and just falls off. And then he's surrounded by his inner circle that do know the truth. There's about four or five of them and they are just fucking feeding it to him. It's like, do you understand if someone had seen that? And just earlier, there were spies from other clans on top of the mountain just overseeing everything, and they somehow missed that. But basically, he just gets roasted by his inner circle saying, you absolute fucking idiot. Don't try and overdo it.
Actually, in the commentary, it was mentioned that Kurosawa actually wanted this film to be a comedy.
Oh, wow. I never knew that.
The gentleman who's the lead actor that you mentioned before, and like I don't know all the background, etc., but he actually had a different main actor who was known for his comedy, like action. Oh, action, wow. Comedy.
So it was okay. So there was a different lead actor in mind for a while.
That's right. And this guy was already locked in. They bring it up in that scene where he's breaking into the jar, and which has Shingen himself in it. And you can sort of see elements in that particular scene of comedy, the way
that's got a little bit of slapstick in it as well. Yeah. Like when he throws the candle behind him and he like freaks out.
Yeah. So this is when they bring it up, and they said that this bloke, he was such a big deal as well in Japan at the time. His last couple of films were huge successes. And when he came in, he told Kurosawa that he would be directing his own scenes and Kurosawa could do the rest of the film. And Kurosawa on the spot said, I'm not putting up with your shit, you're fired. And this guy was like, what? He's going, you're off. I'm not working with you.
So this is what goats do. This is why he's king of the goats.
So he pissed that bloke off and brought in this guy who's obviously, you know, incredible, but he had to temper the film so it wasn't quite as comedic, because this guy obviously had a different skill set with his acting. Yep. To be honest, I thought acting as the thief, he was just spot on.
Oh, he's great.
So, but yeah, that was an interesting little fact.
I did not know that. That is absolutely new to me. I did notice more comedic flourishes this watch round. Like I said, I think this is the fourth time I've watched it, and I just noticed a little bit more of the really dry, subtle comedic beats this time around. And I could probably see where there is a different version of this film where it is a little bit more slapsticky. And I guess the story itself lends itself to that too. There's been comedies made in this very similar premise to this. Wasn't there there's like a Eddie Murphy movie called Trading Places from the early 80s where he takes over the identity of somebody else? I'm sure that was the premise of that film. I've seen it like once or twice. I can't really remember it, but I know that the bones of this type of plot have been used in other films before and a few comedies as well. So I could see what Kurosawa's kind of mindset was there, that this would work as a comedy as well. Now, before we finish up this episode, we have to really touch on that final battle. I mean, we've already spoken a little bit about it, the final battle scene. The scale of this scene is just mind-blowing. And like you said, I didn't have any idea of the real numbers. When you said 5,000 plus extras, that is not an exaggeration. This thing is huge. Was there any talk of any injuries done to horses in this particular scene that you heard of? Because it does seem quite graphic, and it does seem like a lot of horses take significant falls.
This was the first thing after my first viewing. As soon as I got off, I jumped onto Google and searched, did any horses die? Because I'm a huge animal lover.
Yeah, I was a bit icky about this too. I'm a bit of a sook when it comes to animals.
Well, it just so happens, this is really interesting, but Kurosawa's, one of his favorite creatures in the world is the horse. No horse was hurt in this film. So
he's a beautiful man. I should never have doubted him.
So they basically gave all these horses these temporary tranquilizers. It was reported that it was so hard because originally he was hoping that they'd just tranquilize them all and they'd just be laying still for that shot. And then there was some horses already starting to come round and some still going down. And they said they could never get a 3-minute or whatever it was length shot that they were trying to attempt where horses weren't moving. But in the end, using slow motion and all the rest of it, it's way more harrowing with the horses sort of trying to stand. One of them's like on its back, kicking its legs in the air. It's horrifying. See,
that comes across as in this like final stages of life, the way that the horse is kicking out like that. That's, like you said, way more harrowing than just having them fully tranquilized out of their minds on ketamine, just laying down in a K-hole. on the fucking battlefield.
I talk about how I think about the first scene a lot. I think those images stick with me equally as much out of the 3 hours as anything.
It's just an incredible climax to this film. And again, it's a film that has a battle to close, but again, it's not a long battle by any stretch, especially considering other films of its ilk. If you're looking for a film that has more action to it in a similar kind of style, Ran is the film, and spoiler alert, you're going to be talking about this one when we get to 1985. But I just love how this film concludes, especially with the final of him just walking into the water, which again mimics that dream sequence as well.
Mm. It's a magnificent finish to the film, really, how he sees the Tagata banner floating in the river. Obviously, his pride and sentiment is now 100% with his clan trying to reach it, but completely mangled up by all the shots, and then for him to float past it in bloody water is insane.
And how quickly he's taken away by the tide too.
Yeah, a bit like the battle itself, I guess. So, it was a big rush and it was all over as well, in the film anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And that banner in the water, like you said, is such a great final touch. What was the motto again? Is it immovable like a mountain or something? Is that what it was?
Yeah, as unshakable as a mountain.
As unshakable as a mountain. Incredible ending to this film. And look, I've said it 1,000 times on this episode already, but seriously, one of the most beautiful films ever made. I would thoroughly recommend this to anyone who just loves to look at pretty pictures, moving pictures in this case, and just the artistry and the technical proficiency that's on display here. Kurosawa is an absolute master. And I feel like Kagemusha is very underrated still to this day. I know there are pockets of people that really pimp it and really vouch for it. I think it's still vastly underrated, and I would have it easily probably in my top three of Kurosawa's. It's, again, probably the most subtle and at times meandering of his bigger works, but a film that I just will love forever. What are your final thoughts on it, Hulsh?
I'm just going to say one thing for the listeners, and I don't know if you agree with me or not on this, but I think this is one of those films where it may actually be of benefit, especially if you're only going to watch it once, to maybe have a little read up on the culture and a little bit of the history first, because then you can watch it and really just let the visuals and the sound and everything sweep over you and have a little bit of context. To me, if I watched it now and just having that little bit more understanding, and then everything that Kurosawa is trying to use in his toolbox from that visual and sound and, you know, the shadows and everything else, like, it's just, it blows your mind. I know, like, a lot of people out there are not going to be able to watch this twice. Let alone,
oh, fuck no, it's so long. I totally get that for sure.
So, I honestly, if you're going to watch it, if you listen to us, like, that's giving you a little bit of insight, but just have a little bit of a read up and then sit down and watch it, and I bet you any money it blows your mind. Because if you watch it with zero context, and it is quite slow moving, and there's a lot of pieces to this that you're not going to understand what it actually means, but you're going to see, this incredible dreamscape sort of thing and landscapes unfold in front of you. But I think just having a little bit of context would make it just the perfect viewing. And I agree in that this, to me, should be very highly regarded from what I've seen.
Yeah, I like that you've said that, because if you've just got that little bit of context upon a viewing of this, you're not scrambling for a meaning as you're trying to watch it. And that's not going to distract you from what you're actually watching. And it is a visual feast. It is absolute a buffet for the eyes. It is beautiful. And I'm so glad that you enjoyed it, man, especially that dipping your toe in the water of Kurosawa with this film is actually diving in the deep end, really. This is very epic in scope. He's had other films of similar length, but this is, like, again, my opinion, a very personal film for him, and it comes across that way. And I'm just really excited that you liked it. And I hope that our loyal listeners who have tuned in and heard us ramble on about this now for an hour and a half, go ahead, find it and watch it and enjoy it as well. Anything else that you would like to add, mate?
I mean, there's only one negative with that film, and that's just that Joe Spinell didn't make a cameo in it. So
fuck it. Yeah, great point. And I'm fucking disappointed. I was watching out for him. I'm like, is that Joe Spinell? No, that's not him. Because, I mean, he shows up in nearly every other film from 1980. So, you know, let's not put it past the cameo goat.
But no, we're up to the podium.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we've got the podium ahead of us next week. Oh, no, I don't want to give any spoilers away. I don't want to ruin it. But, yeah, we've got a film in the top three that I think most people will expect to be there. We've got a film in the top three that I think a lot of people will say, what the fuck is this? Never heard of it. But please give it a chance. And another film in the top three that is going to be a massive downer for anyone that ever watches it, but it is just an incredible film. And that's all I'm going to say. They're as spoilery as I'm going to get. But thank you very much for tuning in for episode 7.
Yes.
Episode 7. Look at us go. And the film that comes in at number 4 for 1980, Kagemusha from Akira Kurosawa. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week.